You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of May 2012 on Monocle 24. Welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Nancy Durham. Coming up on the show, a new wave of violence hits the Colombian capital of Bogotá. Dial M for Murdoch, Just Out, a book that promises to uncover the inner workings of News Corporation. Co-author Martin Hickman will be live in the studio. The Cannes Film Festival opens with a row. Why, it is being asked, are there no women directors in the competition? And culture editor Robert Bound will join us round the table. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. Now here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news.
Monocle 24 News. Political leaders in Greece have agreed to hold new elections on the 17th of June and have appointed a senior judge as a caretaker prime minister. The latest opinion polls suggest an election victory for a group which is opposed to austerity measures. But speaking in Brussels, the European Commissioner President, José Manuel Barroso, says Greece needs to stick to its agreed reforms.
The problems it addresses are real. This is why the commitments taken by Greece and all the euro area member states should be kept. Not because the European Union or the euro area wishes it to be like that, but because there is no other alternative that has less pain and less difficulties.
Meanwhile, vandals have daubed the house of a top German European Union official working on Greece and set his wife's car on fire in an apparent protest against the cutbacks that international lenders are imposing on Greece. Staying with European news, and Italy has made strong progress in shoring up its public finances and making structural reforms since the arrival of Prime Minister Mario Monti, but must do more to revive economic growth. Reza Mokhadam, a senior International Monetary Fund official, has said today.
I think Italy has come a long way, and the stabilization policies that have been put in place are also essential to create the conditions for a revival of growth. But of course, the job is not yet done. There is good progress, but more needs to be done to revive growth.
A delegation of Canadian Parliament members has added their voice to concerns about the opposition leader Yulia Tymoshenko's imprisonment in Ukraine, while the former Prime Minister's lawyer said they would sue Ukrainian penitentiary and health ministry workers. Bob Deshert, one of the MPs in Kharkiv, said they were denied access to the hospital.
We are here today in this place because we are concerned about the apparent political prosecution and imprisonment of Mrs. Tymoshenko. In our view, this does not bode well for the state of democracy here in Ukraine. We were requested of the Ukrainian government that Mrs. Tymoshenko receive the medical treatment that she requires and that she be released.
The German Chancellor Angela Merkel has today said that Germany will continue to support Afghanistan after its troops leave the country in 2014. She met the Afghan President Hamid Karzai in Berlin. The two leaders signed an agreement which foresees increased cooperation in the areas of education, culture and science. Well, the Afghan President was particularly grateful for German support.
Madam Chancellor, today is particularly important for me to express on behalf of the Afghan people the gratitude of our people for the support that Germany has given to us selflessly and with dedication for the well-being of the Afghan people. The signing today, indeed, Madam Chancellor, turns a new page in our relationship.
And finally, scientists are now saying that dinosaurs struggled with arthritis just like humans do today. Researchers studying a giant 26-foot female Plerosaurus in Bristol here in England found evidence of an arthritis-like disease in its jaw. Usually capable of ripping other dinosaurs to bits with its 8-inch teeth, the weak jaw would eventually have stopped the dinosaur feeding, with the jaw weakening and eventually breaking, leading to her death 150 million years ago. And those are the stories at the top of the hour on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. Poor old dinosaur.
I felt a bit weak at the knees reading that story because I got a weak leg, actually.
Do you?
Yeah, meniscus problem.
Arthritic jaw. That's a
Anyway, sad story,
sad
isn't it?
Story. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much for the news at 5 minutes past the hour. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24, how about ya?
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24,
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The proper Jalavet. Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Afternoon to Monocle 24.
The head at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Colombians in the capital of Bogotá have been jolted by a wave of violence. Yesterday, a bomb exploded in the center of the city, claiming lives of two aides to a former interior minister. Dozens of others were also injured. Monocle correspondent Anastasia Maloney is on the line now from Bogotá. Good evening.
Good evening.
I understand the police have been talking and speculating as to who set this bomb off. Can you tell us?
Yes, the police chief of Bogotá said earlier this morning that he has attributed this bomb attack to the left-wing guerrilla group, the FARC. However, the defense minister and the Colombian president haven't confirmed this. And in the recent statements by the minister of defense just a couple of hours ago, he said that they're still not pointing the finger at the FARC and it's still not certain who exactly carried out this bomb attack.
Okay, thank you for that. And if it is the FARC, does this surprise us? They've been rather quiet, at least in the city.
Correct. This is why it caused so much panic and concern yesterday. When I went onto the streets in Bogotá yesterday around 5, 6 o'clock, it was very, very quiet. It just goes to show how afraid people were. This hasn't been common in Bogotá, in the capital, for quite a few years. And that's why it came as a surprise. The last major bomb attack that happened in Bogotá was in 2003. And Bogotáns have got used to relative calm and security in the city. And this is why this latest incident yesterday caused so much panic.
Looking back at recent days, weeks, months, were there any, you know, hints that something like this might be coming? Or does it really feel like it came out of the blue?
At the moment, it feels like it came out of the blue. However, the Colombian government and its armed forces are always on high alert. FARC attacks do occur. They almost occur, in fact, every week, but they don't occur in the capital. They often take place in remote jungle areas, border areas of Colombia, and it's usually attacks against military police outposts and stations. It's very common in Bogotá recently to have a bomb attack of this nature.
Thoughts on why this particular target? It looks as if they were trying to hit this former interior minister, Fernando Londoño, far right, apparently.
Correct, yes. This is a former minister of interior and justice, so a very high profile and important position. He was the former minister during the previous government of Uribe for 2 years, between 2002 and 2004. And he's very vocal about his hatred of the FARC. He now runs, he hosts a radio program, and he's also been vocal about the FARC. And he also had a big tight security with him, lots of bodyguards and an armored car when he was traveling yesterday because he had received threats from the FARC. So for some people, that they're making the connection then between those threats, those previous threats that the FARC had against him and the attack yesterday.
Okay, and I think you were telling our researcher just a short while ago that Bogotá's mayor has also been speaking out and suggesting that there could be outside forces involved.
Yes, correct. He just said that he believes that it's very likely there was foreign technology involved. What is clear is that it's very the way that the type of bomb was used is not common in Colombia. It's known as a kind of stick bomb where you put the device on an object. In this case, it was the car. What they think happened is that a man placed the bomb on top of the car or on the door of the car. That caused the explosion, which was activated by someone on a motorbike. This kind of tactic hasn't been common, hasn't been used much in Colombia, And the Colombians are saying that this is a tactic often used by ETA, the Spanish terrorist group that now laid down their arms, but when they were at the height of their power in the 1990s, they used this type of tactic. And the Bogotá's mayor was saying that perhaps there is a connection between ETA tactics and the FARC.
Could be groups sharing technology.
Correct.
I suppose. Coincidentally or not, yesterday I think you were on our late night Monocle program talking about that long-awaited trade deal between the USA and Colombia. It just went into effect yesterday. Is that just a random event, or is anybody looking at a connection there?
Yes, in fact, the Bogotá's mayor did say that, you know, it is important to note that that attack was carried out on the day that the free trade agreement with the United States started. And there were protests among students at the big national university, which is the main public university in Bogotá. About 50 students were protesting inside and outside the university. So there's a few disturbances as well. However, that's only the opinion of the Bogotá's mayor. Other people, like the Bogotá's police chief, are saying, you know, this is a FARC attack against, a personal attack against a minister, a former minister.
Anastasia, thanks very much for this. We'll stay in close touch. Anastasia Maloney, our woman in Bogotá.
On the latest episode of Section D, we delve into the realm of faith and design. We visit a new large chapel in the heart of Helsinki, a synagogue in New York that's made its home in a former Gucci store, and we discuss church chairs, nuns' habits, and how graphic design is bringing religious literature into the 21st century.
The anonymity that wearing the habit has given nuns historically. I mean, there are stories of them carrying ammunition hidden under their habit, you know, during the war, and all sorts of interesting things.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
In Tasmania, talented craftspeople are making use of the island's natural materials to design and build furniture and ceramics. Monocle video journalist Gabriel Lee toured the island to meet the designer makers putting Tasmania's personality on the map.
It seemed to me that if I was going to make pots at this time and in this culture, I needed to say something about being here and now. And the way to do that was through the materials.
You can watch this and many more Monocle films, from affairs to business, culture to design, in the programs menu on monocle.com.
This is Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Nancy Durham, and next I have a song for you. Here is Jupiter and Sake. The world-famous Cannes Film Festival gets underway today, and the event has already come under criticism for the absence of female directors competing for the event's top prize, the Palme d'Or. Well, to fill us in on the controversy and tell us what films have got her excited at the event this year, I spoke earlier with critic Karen Krasanovich.
This is not a surprising complaint, and it's made at the Oscars as well. I mean, as we know, really, just recently, Catherine Bigelow won the Oscar, which is very, very rare. And I think what's interesting about this particular argument about sexism at the Cannes Film Festival is that there are 22 films nominated for the competition. I believe it's for the Palme d'Or, and none of them are directed by women, whereas last year four of them were, and two of them were French women. And I think that the point that the women are trying to make is that the film industry, like anywhere else, really, where you're going to have ego, fame, and money, and art, there's going to be a lot of competition for top spots. Mm-hmm. And even having a shot at the top spot is quite difficult. And I think the women are saying that this is a closed shop, it's very buddy-buddy, it's the old boys system, and that really we need to recognize this. And it's an extension of what feminism has been doing for the last 40 years.
And there was, once again, this is not the first time, a protest letter signed by, I guess, among others, I'm not sure, directors Fanny Cottencon and mm-hmm. Virginie Despentes, mm-hmm. who say men love their women to have depth, but only when it comes to their cleavages. Is it really about that?
Well, that's a wonderful line. I think that is a great line. I think serious filmmakers would probably appreciate. I mean, serious female filmmakers. I mean, Andrew Arnold, for example, from Britain, is on the jury this year. Would say, you know, that's a nice sentiment. But I really think they're trying to make a point by saying. That women are really more decorative. They're not being taken seriously. And I think that you could apply that to, and I hate to say women are minority because they're not really. But you could apply that to other people that are not represented equally.
Here.
I think it's a wonderful thing to say. I don't think it's necessarily correct. The film industry is actually a very difficult industry for anybody that wasn't born into it, for anybody that wasn't or hasn't devoted their life completely to it. It's an all-consuming industry. And you only need to look at the careers of, let's say, somebody like David Lynch, who is making films, now finds it quite difficult and maybe a bit boring and goes and works in television. A lot of people have found televisions easier. So in a way, I don't necessarily agree with this argument, but I think it's worth saying.
Okay. So women or maybe and other groups too are playing catch up. It's going to take a bit more time.
Yes, it is. It is simply because there's a lot of money in the hands of white males.
Okay.
Really.
And what have they got to show that's hot and exciting at
Lots
this festival?
Lots of stuff by white males, I have to say.
All right. White male number one.
And there's some yellow males in there, and there's some brown ones and black ones, and yes, all sorts of colors. Actually, we've got some very interesting. It's going to be a very interesting can. I mean, not only starting off with the sexism row, which I think, I will leave it there, but I think it is an interesting point. We've got the great thing about Cannes. And you won't get this with other film festivals, for example, in America, is the wonderful European emphasis of it and also international emphasis. So we've got some terrific things. Cronenberg, Canadian, is coming back with a film called Cosmopolis, which has Twilight's Robert Pattinson in it, our Pats, if you like. And it's a throwback. It looks like it's going to be a throwback to the Cronenberg that we all loved many, many years ago.
Scary, creepy,
weird, creepy, dark, sexy, surprising. And that is going to be the really hot ticket. In fact, it's closing Cannes.
Cosmopolis.
Yes,
okay.
Which is fantastic. And the opening film is Moonrise Kingdom, which has got Bill Murray in it, which is a Wes Anderson film, which is quirky, crazy, brightly colored. He also did the Darjeeling Express. It's very, very, very much like a Whit Stillman movie, only sort of more updated. But there's so many wonderful films I could just go. There's Romania's Beyond the Hills. Iran has Someone in Love, Michael Haneke from Austria, Amour, Mexico, Italy, Denmark, Egypt, so many other films.
Great, great international selection.
It's tremendous. And that's really what Cannes is about. Another wonderful thing about Cannes is that there are quirky selections. Cannes makes these selections of the Palme d'Or winner and its other prizes that it has that always confound the rest of the festival goers and other festivals. Because Cannes has got this quirkiness that no other festival has. For example, they awarded, a really, really long and many people found boring Thai film, Uncle Boon Me, which was, it was like, you know, eyes glowing in the darkness. You know, it was just baffling. But they picked that as best film. And that gives films that you wouldn't normally see a wonderful platform to be
What
seen.
Is it about the French or the location that makes it such a quirky festival? Any ideas?
Oh, gosh. Oh, that's a great question. I've never been asked that.
Well, good.
You know, all my years of going to Cannes, I haven't.
Well, I was just there. No, I wasn't. I was just in Nice. But we can pretend Cannes was because it's very similar. And it is like being on a movie set for a start. And the couple, you know, we're standing there embracing and kissing beautifully. On the parapet, sticking out over the beach. Mm. So maybe if there's something about it, people are there and it feels like they're in the movies.
Very much so. It is very much like a French romance. It's a setting. It's a setting for a festival. It's a jewel of a festival. It's beautiful Everybody goes there. The parties are amazing. Surprising things happen there. It's warm. The stars wear these, you know, very chic, very revealing outfits, which, you know, and we marvel at them because they play us in the movies. And so we just love them. But also there's a history of sort of outrageousness of where back in the 50s, an actress, and I've forgotten her name, unfortunately, pulled off her bra or pulled off the top of her swimsuit and got a lot of coverage, and as it were. And that's really where it started off. It's a sexy festival. It's an outrageous festival, but it's also a very serious festival.
That was Karen Krasanovich talking with me earlier. And now a little bit of music for you. This is First Aid Kit with I Found a Way.
It's me, you've come to take my due.
And that was First Aid Kit with I Found a Way. In the next half hour on Midori House, a culture chat with Robert Bound and Martin Hickman, co-author of Dial M for Murdoch, will be with us. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thanks very much, Nancy. Political leaders in Greece have agreed to hold new elections on the 17th of June and have appointed a senior judge as a caretaker prime minister. The latest opinion polls suggest an election victory for a group which is opposed to austerity measures. Meanwhile, vandals have dubbed the house of a top German European Union official working on Greece and set his wife's car on fire in an apparent protest against the cutbacks. Elsewhere in Europe, a senior International Monetary Fund official has today said that Italy has made strong progress in shoring up its public finances and making structural reforms since the arrival of Prime Minister Mario Monti. A delegation of Canadian Parliament members has added their voice to concerns about the opposition leader Yulia Tymoshenko's imprisonment, while the former Prime Minister's lawyer said they would sue Ukrainian penitentiary and health ministry workers. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel has today said that Germany will continue to support Afghanistan after its troops leave the country in 2014. She met the Afghan President Hamid Karzai in Berlin. The two leaders signed an agreement which foresees increased cooperation in the areas of education, culture and science. The Afghan President was particularly grateful for Germany's support. And those are the stories for the moment here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. And now I'm joined in the studio by our culture editor, Robert Bound. And Robert, you are just back from Cuba.
I know. I thought I'd try and put on something that kind of gave me balance the color of my face today. I'm wearing a bright green sweater.
It's even brighter than emerald green. And it's quite lovely. Did you pick it up in Havana?
I didn't pick it up in Havana. Damn it. Has it got that feel about it? Slightly threadbare.
You've got a Hemingway thing about you. There's something about your skin, a little bit of color. And your hair is just sort of flopping. Looks like you've had a good time in Havana.
I did have a daiquiri at Floridita.
Good.
As well, in honor of the great man.
Excellent.
And you were there. We were just talking off mic about you saw Fidel, didn't you?
I did.
A cigar in his mouth, no less.
1980 or 81, standing by Jose Marti, the great tall monument.
Yeah, it's amazing, that thing.
Fantastic. Nobody around. And I was with my then boyfriend. We were talking about Fidel. Wouldn't it be great to see him? And he drove by with a cigar, sitting in the back of one of those expensive but unusual big black cars.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what it was. But it was him.
It's amazing. I think you channeled him. I think you brought him to you by the power of thought.
Or maybe he was just at that time where he was kind of going around hoping someone would see him because there weren't too many people in the streets.
Oh, really? Yes, exactly. He was trying to drum up some votes. Maybe,
yeah.
Again.
But what a fantastic place.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place. It's an absolutely amazing place. I think I fell in love with it in the sort of 4 days or 5 days I was there. I was there for the 11th Havana Biennale. And it, talking of that great monument, that huge sort of obelisk, there's a lot of works of art. There were lots of works of art in the Biennale that sort of channeled that, actually, that had that in them, because it's such a sort of focal point for Cubans and, you know, Havanians. Havanians? Can we say that? Habaneans.
I bet it's Habaneans. Habaneans. They sound like those flip-flops people keep buying.
Exactly. Yeah. But no, it was a really wonderful show. It's the 11th Havana Biennial. A lot of people maybe would know that. It's not every 2 years. That's the thing, Nancy, because it costs a lot of money to put a Biennale on.
So it's and the try. Or
so
the
it's sort of, yeah, quattro. They have one every 4 years or one every 3 years and one every sort of. So,
but and it is it art everywhere, different locations, happenings?
Yeah, so it's everywhere. So there's the Teatro in Parque Central is where the sort of main show, one of the main shows is. And then there's the castle up on the hill, which name escapes me. I think people can Google that, can't they?
I think they can.
Where there are lots of sort of interactive pieces, lots of young artists, and these are displayed in the sort of dungeons and tunnels and places where they'd have stored the cannon and the cannonball and all the rest of it. And they're topped off now. This place is topped off now by these beautiful gardens and all this very, some of it quite edgy contemporary art coming straight out of Cuba. It's really amazing to see it.
And did you feel that you took in a Cuban look? Something different, some different feel.
Yeah, well, a lot of it's interesting because obviously it's a country which is a lot of it is quite divided. There is critique of Castro's government or Castro's brother's government in the art. It's quite subtle, but a lot of Cubans, you know, you asked them. I interviewed artists, I interviewed gallerists, I interviewed curators there, and everyone was sort of fed up with answering the question of, you know, whether or not it's difficult to make art that's in any way political or, you know, critiquing the sort of different layers of society and all the rest of it. And of course it's not. They say, well, you have the same problems in your society, really. Bureaucracy is pretty crap, but it is in your... La, la, la. So there's a lot of that, but there's some really beautiful art, some great stuff. It was nice to see Cuban artists using more modern materials, doing video installation or doing video works, installation works, using neons, using high-tech stuff to get their message across, rather than always riffing on the very complicated history of Havana, trying to maybe, you know, make plans for the future with their works of art.
Nice. Any most memorable installation, perhaps?
I thought all the works at the Cuban Pavilion itself, which is this beautiful sort of modernist sort of roof, essentially, which fits all these other things underneath it, was full of really fascinating booths. In terms of individual works, I think it's kind of worth just taking a sort of grand tour around there. Lots of them, very, as I say, very modern contemporary pieces, very witty. And yeah, there seems to be, because the art school, the art school is worth visiting there. It's called ISA. And it's more difficult to get into, I think, than any art school in the world. You have to sort of, unless you're top of your class, in every discipline, you can't even take the exam to get into the art school there. So they've got an amazing, like all the sort of public services are phenomenally good, and the public schools are phenomenally good.
So, and that school produces good artists?
Produces very, very good artists. And the gallery scene itself is sort of interesting. There's two or three really high-quality ones who are 30% owned by the state, which is very strange, considering the shark pool antics of the art world, Nancy, as you know. Sort of, it's amazing to think that some of that government, some of that money goes back to the government when the artists themselves are critiquing it.
Did you buy any?
I did buy a painting, yeah, which is more simple. It's a slightly cubist, slightly beautiful lady that I picked up.
Lovely.
I'd like to point out that's a painting, not an actual lady. I'm not like that. I don't do that sort of thing.
I know you don't do that when you're away, but you've got that green, wonderful green jumper. It's very kind of unmodeled.
It looks like I've got a glint in my eye, doesn't it?
No, it looks like you've got a glint on your body. You look great. You always bring lovely music back.
Oh, yes, music. Now, there was some great music. I did do a sort of random surf of a record shop, and in the airport, I did a random surf of some music. But I wanted to do one of the things that was going on during the Biennale week was Habana Club, the big rum brand, sponsor a lot of the shows there. Sponsor a really great show. And they also brought Giles Peterson over, the British DJ, who's, you know, the go-to man for sort of world music and anything slightly underground. He put together a wonderful compilation. And I think I'm going to pick a random track.
Great. Thank you very much.
Chango un soro dara cuele a luya cuele a cuco o que de aina un soro abba ache aguachela aguachela aguache.
Nice choice. Thank you, Robert Bound. That was Orisa featuring Dreiser and Sesto Sentido. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And after this break, we're going to meet the author, one of the authors of Dial M for Murdoch.
Bit like a documentary film, but without any pictures.
There are some actors, there are quite a lot of musicians.
Festival.
Galleries. Dance.
You're cordially invited to tune in to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. The show that wants to tell you about the music, art, books, films and media we think you should know about wherever in the damn world you've pitched your tent.
Some people collect shoes and other people collect Ferraris. I collect art.
In the latest edition, we celebrate the art of wandering with writer and psychogeographer Ian Sinclair. Enjoy live music from Astrid Williamson, kick-ups and dusty grooves in Chicago, and are led through a chaotic maze in Paris by Jean Deloisy.
You have all the transformation of the self-portrait of Picasso slowly becoming a minotaur.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Weekends on Monocle 24 are for relaxing, taking stock of the week's events, and keeping an eye on the week ahead. The Review is our hour-long Saturday show, looking back at the books, TV shows, films, and events that have made our week, as well as a regular magazine review. Monocle Weekly, our original audio offering, is where it all started. Tyler Brulé, Robert Bound, and Andrew Tuck discuss the week ahead with guests, analysis, and a good helping of music. Perfect Sunday listening. And if you need a short, concise summary of the week's highlights, look no further than The Curator, in association with Rolex, a one-hour roundup of all the juiciest bits of the past week on Monocle 24. So listen to The Review, Monocle Weekly, and The Curator for the full Monocle 24 weekend experience, either live on Monocle 24, on our timeshift player at monocle.com, or on iTunes.
This is Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Nancy Durham. Dial M for Murdoch. That's the title of a new and fast-paced account of Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation and the corruption of Britain. The title is a takeoff on Hitchcock, well-deserved when you consider the behaviour that's become associated with the end of the news of the world. Spying, bullying, eavesdropping, email interception, just to name a few. The book is co-authored by Labour MP Tom Watson and the independent newspaper journalist Martin Hickman. And I'm delighted to say that Martin is joining us in the studio right now.
Hello.
Hello. I have to say, you've got a heck of a cover here and a great title. It really does tell the story, I think.
That's right. We wanted something that was quite serious, but also gave a hint to some of the sort of dramatic side of the story. So I think it's a cover that's fairly rich, as well as being serious.
And yeah, and it's a very creepy story on some levels. And I'd like to start with your role in this saga. When you were meeting cloak and dagger almost with Tom Watson as this started to unfold, can you just take us back to when the moment when you got involved in this and knew this is a big story coming?
That's right. I was an old university friend of Tom Watson, who's been the Labour MP who's pushed most of this forward. And I kept on seeing that he was taking on Murdoch, and it intrigued me. And one day, because we'd lost touch, I called him up and said, well, you know, why are you doing this? And that was in the sort of back end of 2010. And very shortly after, we started working on it together, and we would meet in bars sort of when he wasn't very well known and talk about the latest episodes and put stories into the paper.
And in breakfast meetings before you went off to the paper and what have you?
That's right. We used to meet at a bar in Waterloo called The Fire Station, which we chose because it wasn't frequented by either journalists or politicians. So it was sort of away from the hubbub, if you like.
Was there, I don't want to over, you know, egg this, but was there a nervousness, a creepiness around meeting and planning and getting ready to kind of take on this beast?
Absolutely. When I really became involved properly at the beginning of 2011, it was a very strange story to be covering because it was clearly a huge scandal, yet it wasn't appearing in most of the newspapers in Britain. And actually, that gave you a sort of an eerie sense, really. Why weren't these other newspapers covering the story? How much power was being wielded behind the scenes by Rupert Murdoch and his executives in Britain? So it was all a bit odd.
What, as you got involved and learned more, what surprised you most or overwhelmed you or shocked you about what you were uncovering?
I think it was two things. One was just the sheer extent of the wrongdoing. We slowly realised that this wasn't just the phone hacking of a few royal aides or even a few celebrities. You know, these were thousands of people across the whole of British public life who'd had their privacy invaded. Not only that, but it also went into computer hacking. We now know it involves police corruption and the corruption of other public officials. So one thing was the sheer scale of the wrongdoing. And the other thing was the sophistication and persistence of the cover-up. So over a number of years, News International, Mr. Murdoch's newspaper empire in the UK, lied time and time again about the wrongdoing and the extent of it. And unfortunately, they had a lot of politicians and police officers who were on their side.
That brings us to the word collusion. Is that the right word to use there? The diagrams one could draw between press, police, politicians, in power, opposition, would be quite remarkable and complex.
They would indeed. For a number of years, the Metropolitan Police didn't investigate this scandal properly. They kept on coming out with misleading statements. And also the Prime Minister, David Cameron, kept on laughing it off. And of course, now his Director of Communications, who was forced to leave his job last year, is on police bail for phone hacking and corruption himself, being a former editor of the News of the World. So this is a story which really links private detectives doing bad things with, ultimately, the Prime Minister of this country.
You talk about laughing it off, and the expression LOL comes to mind, which I understand can be lots of laughs, lots of love, and it makes me think of the connections between the Prime Minister. He was texting with, I guess, the then Rebecca Wade, or Brooks, I'm not sure what stage that was at. Text messages signed off this way.
That's right.
What does it stand for, do you think? LOL.
Well, David Cameron apparently believed it stood for lots of love, whereas most people obviously think it stands for laugh out loud. Really, the significance of him signing off those messages to Rebecca Brooks, the chief executive of News International, in that way, is it just shows the closeness between very, very senior politicians and very, very senior representatives of Mr. Murdoch's empire, some of whom, like Mrs. Brooks, have been arrested and, like Mrs. Brooks, have been charged with criminal offences. The other sort of interesting sideshow to all of this was the police horse Raisa, who was loaned to Mrs. Brooks by the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police after a lunch a few years ago, and on which David Cameron himself went riding. And so both of these things, this sort of LOL at the end of messages and this police horse, which was given to Rebecca Brooks by the police and was ridden by the Prime Minister, have come to symbolise the sort of closeness between these newspaper executives and both police officers and politicians.
Today at the Leveson Inquiry, we have Jack Straw, the former Justice Secretary, talking about his weekly train rides with Mrs. Brooks.
Yes,
gossip sessions, right?
Yes, not yet another fascinating detail, which says a lot, really. Mr. Straw, who is a Justice Secretary and of course, a long-standing Labour cabinet minister, realised that he was taking the same train journeys as Mrs. Brooks and asked his officials to arrange it so they could sit together. So every morning they would discuss what was in the papers and apparently gossip about political figures. And it's this sort of friendliness which I think may have been a factor in why the phone hacking wasn't properly investigated for a number of years.
Leveson Inquiry is going to go on for some time, correct?
Yes.
So we're going to be treated to many more morsels.
we've got weeks and weeks ahead of more appearances by senior politicians. So David Cameron, Tony Blair and Gordon Brown all expected to take the stand, if you like, in the Leveson inquiry. And we're likely to hear a lot more about their personal relationship, not only with Mrs. Brooks, but of course with Mr. Murdoch himself.
Do you think the worst is out? I mean, I'm thinking of the tapping of Millie Dowler's phone when she'd gone missing, later to be found murdered. These atrocious things that have been reported, the stars that have come forward and talked about their lives being relationships ruined, families upset. Have we heard the worst of it, do you think?
We may well have heard the very worst cases. It's harder to think of a worse case than hacking the phone of a missing 13-year-old, Millie Dowler, as well as those of victims of terrorist bombs. But I think we've probably only heard the half of the total number of cases out there. And I think there'll be lots more cases involving not just celebrities, but other people who sort of stumbled into the public eye over coming months. And one area that I think will be particularly important is computer hacking. We've heard a lot about the ability of News International journalists to listen to mobile phone messages. But I think we will find out a lot more in coming months about their ability to penetrate people's PCs and read their emails.
But I haven't had the book in my hands for long, but I find it very compelling right off the start. And initially I thought, July, Murdoch's coming to testify, been there, done that. You know, I sat at home and watched every second of it very closely. But what we're getting from you and from Tom Watson, your co-author, is this ringside seat. For instance, we all remember the pie in the face of Murdoch. And
yes.
Watson goes over to sort of, I think, try to see if everybody's okay, a sort of nice gesture. And he overhears one of Murdoch's aides say, "Don't worry, this will play well."
That's right. I think it speaks to the cynicism of News International. Of course, this is a company which persistently claimed that phone hacking was the work of only one rogue reporter and that there were very few victims. We now know that there were thousands of victims, and we also know that they mounted a cover-up and lied and lied and lied. So I think really Murdoch watchers looking at his appearance at the Leveson inquiry would have been laughing out loud quite a few times at some of the things he said. He said he doesn't do deals with politicians. He said he never uses his newspapers or his TV stations to advance his commercial interests. And yeah, I don't think there's much credibility in either claim there.
Do you think they get it? Are they in another orbit?
Well, I think one of the things that's difficult for Rupert Murdoch and his executives to grapple with is just how far they've fallen in public esteem. So these are people who, you know, frankly, are used to telling politicians what they want to happen. They've always had a big say in British politics over the past two or three decades. And they find it very difficult to adjust to their new position in public life. So we saw yesterday the statement from Rebecca Brooks after she'd been charged with conspiring to pervert the course of justice. And she went on to the attack and said, "This is a witch hunt. I shouldn't have been charged. This is an outrageous and unjust decision." Well, frankly, you know, we should wait until we get the court case. And if there's no merit to the case, I'm sure it will be thrown out.
Co-authoring a book. This book is really the story of Tom Watson and of yourself. And you're sharing it, so you've got that you've got that challenge. What are you going to call yourselves? How are you going to write it? You decided on the third person. Is that awkward, or how did that work for you when you were writing it?
It was always going to be difficult to write a book in which I played a minor role and Tom, my co-author, played a much more major role. And essentially we had a choice between whether we wrote it in the first person or the third person. And I think overall it was the right decision to write it in the third person. Some people have said that at passages they found that to be a little awkward, but I think it was probably the best solution. And Dial M for Murdoch's been very well reviewed.
Do you think you might have a sequel? I mean, Hitchcock had more than one.
We will update it at some stage. There will be a paperback edition, although I don't think that'll be for a number of months. Really, what's happened over the last few weeks in terms of our discovery of the government's leaking of inside information about the takeover of B Sky B to News Corp really just cements the thesis in the book about the connections between newspaper executives and politicians and senior police officers. So although we've got a lot of interesting detail over the past few weeks, it really only confirms what's in the book.
Thank you very, very much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Okay, that was Martin Hickman, co-author of Dial M for Murdoch. I nearly said the wrong word there. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. Time for just one more song before we wrap our show, and this is Take It In by Hot Chip. And that was Hot Chip with Take It In. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank my producers, Daniel Giacopelli and Katie Bilboa, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Alex Jakes. In 3 hours, that's 2200 London time, Ted Kravitz and Emma Nelson will be here with the Monocle Daily. Up next is the news, followed by this week's episode of The Entrepreneurs with Jonathan Openshaw. You've been listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Nancy Durham. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.